Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey everybody, welcome to The Last Laugh. I'm Matt Wilstein from The Daily Beast, and this is a big one. Today, I am joined by one of my all-time favorite comedians and someone I've been wanting to get on this show for a long time, Patton Oswalt. Patton's new stand-up special premieres today on Netflix. It's called I Love Everything, which is about as far removed as possible from the title of his previous special, 2017's Annihilation. That major shift in tone reflects how far the comedian has come emotionally since losing his wife, the crime writer Michelle McNamara, just over 4 years ago. Last year, Patton turned 50. And in this clip from the new special, he breaks down where that puts him in the grand scheme of things.
And if you were to fly a helicopter low over the earth, you know what you would see? You'd see people in their 20s gobbling drugs, eating delicious food, having sex. People in their 30s with actual jobs making the world run. People in their 40s trying to fuck the 20-year-olds. And then us, the gentle, surrendered 50-year-olds on our little futility ovals. We've got our earbuds in, listening to podcasts. Which are done by 20-year-olds that nobody wants to fuck. And then on the podcasts, 30-year-olds are selling boner pills to the 40-year-olds. And then way off in the distance are 60-year-olds vaguely afraid of Muslims. And that's the world we live in. So don't fight that cycle, folks. That's just how it is.
On today's episode, Patton and I chat about what his life has been like over these last few years and how he's coping during the shutdown without being able to get on stage and tell jokes. We also look back at just a few of the many highlights from his career, including his first ever acting gig on Seinfeld, his late night stand-up debut on Conan, and his legendary Star Wars filibuster on Parks and Rec. Before we get to our conversation, I've just got a quick request. If you are enjoying this show, please let us know by leaving a rating and review on Apple Podcasts. If you have ideas for guests you want to hear on the show or questions you want me to ask comedians, they just might end up in a future episode. But now, here's me and Patton Oswalt.
Okay, I'm recording.
All right.
And there we go.
Oh, so, okay, cool. There you are. How are you doing? How's your quarantine life going?
I think my quarantine is just like pretty much everyone else's, you know, trying to keep each day energized, I guess, as energized as it can be. But, you know, knowing with kind of a Groundhog Day setting, I guess.
Mm-hmm. I see you shaved your beard.
Yeah.
You had a good beard going.
May 1st, it was just getting so itchy. I don't grow nice, luxurious beards. I grow scratchy, hillbilly beards, and they're no fun.
Yeah. So how have you kind of been occupying your time? Have you been doing the whole homeschooling thing? Because I know for parents, that's been a big part of this.
Doing the homeschooling thing Monday through Friday, and then Saturday and Sunday, we try to find, like, crafts and activities for them to do, and them.
Yeah.
I have one daughter, but it feels like a them sometimes. She's gotten really obsessed with the American version of The Office, so we're working our way through that.
That's a good activity.
One of the parents at school formed a movie club, so every week they watch a new movie, then they discuss it, which is really cool. So we've been doing The Truman Show and Groundhog Day, and so that's been really interesting.
Did you tell her that you auditioned to be Dwight?
I showed her the, there's a YouTube video of all of the other auditions. So I showed that to her.
Yeah.
And got a couple of dad points. But Rainn Wilson is such a better Dwight. I'm so glad that he got that part. Because man, was he amazing.
Yeah. I want to talk about your new special, do you feel like this is a good time to be releasing a stand-up special because everyone's stuck at home with nothing else to do but watch Netflix?
Well, I mean, I would like it to be a good time to release a stand-up special because everyone's in a good mood and mm-hmm. I can add to the happiness, take the, it's a good time to release a stand-up special for very bad reasons and then mm-hmm. everyone is stressed out and stuck in their homes. I wish that wasn't why it was a good reason, but there you go.
Yeah. I mean, it is so funny how how stand-up material that was taped a few months ago can feel different now. Just thinking about, the special ends with this long bit about Denny's. And I was thinking there are people who would kill to go sit in a Denny's and just be in a restaurant, any restaurant right now.
I would kill to go sit in a Denny's right now. I would, a lot of my writing got done in restaurants. I would just go and, order a mm-hmm. cup of decaf and a sandwich and just sit and write and with the sounds. That's, wow, somebody should, I wonder if there's like a music track you can download and put in a loop of like cafe sounds or restaurant sounds around you, like while you write. That'll be, because I do a lot of writing and reading to thunderstorm sounds. I remember mm-hmm. I went and saw that. It was a thing at LACMA, Guillermo del Toro's like art exhibit of all of his collected art.
Oh, yeah.
Apparently has a room in his house that he rigs up that it's raining all the time. Like he has this thing on the window where it's like it simulates rain hitting the window and he has like thunderstorm sounds and it's lit like there's a thunderstorm. And that's where all of his
writing.
That's
amazing.
Yeah, so I do that with just, I have a little thing on my iPad. I mean, my iPod that I downloaded like a thunderstorm and I just played on a loop while I'm reading.
You gotta find cafe noises.
Cafe noises, yes. Starbucks noises, annoying Starbucks patrons.
Or maybe we could just get a bunch of people together on Zoom drinking coffee and kind of,
that would be great.
I could simulate it. Yeah. So your special is called I Love Everything, which is quite a big turnaround from your previous special, which was called Annihilation.
Yeah.
Does that reflect your mood or does that, the title kind of?
Yeah, I think it reflects just that kind of resurging of the life force after being in so much darkness and then, mm-hmm. Being back in the light that way that you really appreciate the good things in a much more better way. You're like a man who was dying of thirst that gets a sip of water and it's the most luxurious, delicious water he's ever had. So mm-hmm. that's kind of how life felt to me after coming out of all that.
Yeah. I mean, I've heard you say that after you taped your previous special, you really just stopped doing that material altogether. And obviously a lot of it was about the death of your wife. So does that make it even harder to kind of build up this new hour where there's no kind of transition from one to the next? It's just like a hard break.
Well, I mean, every time I finish a special and once it airs, I'm done with that material. You can't do that mm-hmm. material again. So it's always been that way. It's always been a hard break of, okay, that stuff is done. Although, I didn't really tour on that material. Once I did the special, I didn't mm-hmm. want to ever do that material again. So there was a bit of a time off when I had to work up a new hour. I never, once a special's out, you can't ever do that material again.
Mm-hmm. So then in this case, what was the process like for you of developing the new hour? Was it did it feel any different than previous ones?
I just had to do a lot more smaller open mics and a lot more writing on, weeknights and chunks and stuff like that in order to do it. And then, mm-hmm. Once I got up to close to the new hour, I started going back out on the road again and doing theaters and building it up to that hour.
Yeah. Of course, that's something that you can't do now. How much are you missing the ability to get up and do stand up now?
I'm missing it so terribly. I can't. I wish that I had the discipline, or I wish that my process was sitting at a table and writing jokes, but that's not how it works for me. It works for me getting up on stage. Some comedians can sit and write, some can't. I'm one of those that has to be up on a stage, so it's been a little rough.
Mm-hmm. Have there been anything that you've tried to do? I know a lot of people have been doing these like live streams, you know, or Instagram lives and things to kind of get that, get a sense of that experience.
I think that's better for like musicians and stuff. For comedians, I need the crowd there. And I just think it looks weird. It just doesn't work if you're there doing it just into a camera with when you can't hear anybody. It just feels strange.
Yeah.
It's not the same thing.
Yeah. I was kind of shocked to hear you say in the special that you turned 50 last year, just because I kind of think of you as, you know, a young alt comic, and that was your identity for so long. So it is kind of odd to have you arrive at this place for us fans.
Yeah.
Is that, you know, I was thinking about, I had Maria Bamford on the show a few months ago, and we talked a lot about the Comedians of Comedy, which is just one of my all-time, you know, favorite things.
Oh,
and,
thanks, man.
And really impacted, you know, my appreciation of stand-up and love for comedy. And she said you were really the driving force behind that tour and that film. Mm-hmm. So what do you, when you think about that time in your life, how do you think about that? Because it really was just like she described it as kind of like just a week that became, you know, this thing that has lasted on so much.
Yeah, it was very much like it came out of a lot of frustration. I was getting a lot of attention because of being on King of Queens, and I suddenly was getting headlining gigs because of it. But the people that were coming out to see me were like, well, we enjoy this 8 p.m. family show, and it was a great show to be on. But I'm like, if I don't take control over how I present myself and finding my audience, I can't just be lazy and just coast on being on a TV show because my comedy is different than what, you know, is on the show. They're two different things. They're two totally valid, funny things, but I can't just expect to go, well, I'm on TV, I'm just going to get headlining gigs. So I started figuring out that the audience that I needed was in smaller clubs, music clubs, alt music scene clubs. I did a gig at a part of a celebration, multi-day celebration at the 40 Watt in Athens. And the gig was, it was like this, such a revelation of like, oh, this is the audience I want to pursue. So I really started putting together, you know, smaller music venues, with some friends. The first one was just me and Zach went out, as a pair. And then I decided to turn it into a bigger tour with, added Maria and Brian. It was also, It was out of frustration for my career, and it was also my frustration as a comedy fan, because at the time, I didn't think that Brian Posehn and Maria Bamford and Zach were being showcased correctly and in the right venue. So to be able to bring them all together on the tour really meant a lot, you know, to be able to kind of go, this is who you guys should be into, these people, you know, like if you like what I'm doing, you should really be into these guys because they're amazing. So, you know, it just felt really good to be able to do that, you know, to two levels, for selfishly for myself, and then also as a fan for my friends.
Yeah, I found it so fascinating to, I rewatched the film not too long ago, and to see you know, fans coming up to Brian Posehn from, you know, knowing him from Just Shoot Me, and just like ignoring Zach Galifianakis, who nobody knew who he was yet, and now he's, you know, gone on to such an insane career.
Yeah, it was amazing, too, to see audiences not really know about Maria Bamford and not really be on her wavelength. And then by the end of the tour, like, the word was just out and people totally got what she was doing and how brilliant she was and still is. And it was amazing to see that, to see people go, oh, wow, we get to discover this genuinely, genuinely different voice and comedy that is incomparable to anything else out there.
So I got to see you perform some of the material that's in the special at that event at Largo for Gary Gulman.
Yes.
His special. And that was such a fascinating
How
event.
How great was that special?
Yeah, the special was amazing. And then it was so fun to see you and Maria and Judd and him all there at Largo, and kind of have that conversation about mental health and comedy and all of that. How have you kind of been thinking about that, especially now, you know, where everyone's kind of struggling and going through this hard time in terms of how comedy, you know, can sort of how you can use your comedy to work through some of that stuff in terms of, you know, how you're feeling,
yeah,
mental health.
I mean, you know, one thing you can do, especially on social media, if you have a big following, is you can just be and in a very do it in a fun way. But acknowledge that, yeah, there's some days when the depression hits really, really hard because now we don't have those circadian rhythm signals like we used to of sun and light and darkness and time and dates. There's, you know, people are like, I don't even know what day it is right now. And that's kind of a, you know, I see that people's sleep schedules are getting really, really messed with, and an erratic sleep schedule is a shortcut to, you know, mental illness. So that can really affect people. So, but what can help them out of it is seeing and hearing other people going, yeah, let me tell you what I'm going through. It's like, or yeah, me too. Same thing. I know exactly what you're talking about. That really, really helps. So, you know, trying to do it in a kind of a winking, funny, almost shoulder shrug way of like, oh God, yeah, I absolutely know what you're talking about. And also just, I think having a network of people, like there's people that I know that are struggling with mental illness that I've helped them and they've helped me. And so we check in on each other. Like the first thing you do is actually, I didn't do it early on in the shutdown. I didn't know how long the shutdown was going to take. So I'm like, well, I'm not going to call them on day two and go, are you okay? Like put that into their heads that they should be. But then after like a week and a half, I started checking in. I'm like, hey, this looks like it might be longer than we all thought. So I wanted to make sure you're doing okay. And you can, you know, and you know, you have like, I have Zoom hangouts with friends. We just schedule like, oh, I got to go do this thing. So, you know, we'll all watch the same movie and then we'll get together and talk about that. And which is beyond helpful. All my little movie nerd friends like me, having them to argue about stuff is great. You know?
I can see from your social media too, that you are very, tapped into the news and to, the response to the crisis Trump.
We
and
all
that
are
stuff.
Because it is so absolutely affecting us, you know, and it's very, very frustrating when you see people like people's economic and job frustration being weaponized to benefit the rich. You know, it's when I understand, obviously you sympathize with people that are out there going, you know, reopen businesses and stuff because they have to go work, but those kind of protests are being astroturfed by wealthy people to get those people back working for them, and they're the ones being put at risk. So it's a little, it's kind of the height of evil when you see the Fox and Friends people who are all coming in remote studios and safe from each other going, we need to end this social distancing, don't you think? And it's like, why don't you guys do it first? That like you're seeing them throwing bodies onto the barbed wire to benefit themselves. And it feels,
and of course they're all recording their shows from home.
Exactly. They're all recording their shows from home. So it's just, and by the way, they should be recording their shows from home. They should be keeping safe, but don't be doing that and then telling other people, hey, get out there. You know, you guys get like, you're safe in the bunker and guys get out there. Come on, America first.
I wanted to ask you about another piece of your special where you do briefly talk about Trump and you kind of say that, you know, it's almost futile to make jokes about him because it's like you can't heighten it any more than it's already there.
It was like I was on the roast of Flavor Flav and Jeff Ross went up and said, how do you shame a crackhead who wears a Viking helmet? Like, what is our function here even at this point?
Yeah.
And that it's the same thing of like, how do you parody a parody? How do you parody of someone who's a bad comedian trying to get jokes and get attention and shit like that? You know, it doesn't really make, after a while, you're like, the insanity and stupidity of his daily existence and our daily letting it happen is going to steamroller anything you're going to come up with as a joke. And it's also amazing how so many, like when I posted the poster for the special and then later this week I'm going to post the trailer, there's always a swarm of MAGA people on Instagram and Twitter going, oh, this is just going to be Trump bashing. There's no way I'm watching this. Like, these are the same people that are like, you know, facts don't care about your feelings and you snowflake libtards. But if there's even the possibility that there's this single nudging of their bloated idol, they're like, I don't even want to see this. I don't even want to look at that. You know, so that kind of, again, how do you make fun of that? Like they're already being the Christopher Guest movie characters that you like, I can't top this. I can't top this. I can't top this desperation and this fear on the part of these so-called alpha males that are out there, you know.
That's what I always think about SNL and the way they, you know, cover Trump is that it's often, and they've done this with him, but it's not just Trump, but they did it with Sarah Palin too. They were kind of just repeating word for word what these people say, and there's not that much heightening to it. So it's not even really, it's just kind of like recreating it for people.
Yeah. I think at the height of the, right during the, once we got into the Iraq war, there was a play that was put on, I think Dakin Matthews was in it and stuff, but it was just reading the transcripts of the lead up to the Iraq war and how all that, they didn't change anything. And it was hilarious. The reasoning and the insanity, it was like a, it's like something Terry Southern would write, except it was the transcripts.
Yeah.
That's how crazy things were. So, you know, how do we satirize the transcript of our reality right now?
Yeah. There's a lot of people trying, you know, every night on late night TV.
God bless them. You know, but I mean, the people that are really doing it are the ones that are actually leaning even further into the absurdities.
I was curious what you thought about Trump's use of sarcasm recently.
That is every idiot that you've ever worked a shitty office job with who thinks that he or she is funny and they're not. And the people who, it's always the people who aren't funny who insist that they are. And they'll say something horrible and then everyone in the office is pissed off and like, why? It's like, I was being sarcastic or I was punking you. It's just that desperate someone who's never been funny trying to make themselves seem awesome after the fact. Your explanation for telling Americans to perhaps ingest bleach or disinfectant was that you were being sarcastic. So let's rewind that. At the height of a pandemic, when we're approaching 70,000 deaths, your plan was to go out and be sarcastic and snarky about the whole thing. Either way, it's hard. Like, there's no, it goes back to, it's the Homer Simpson. I thought the cop was a prostitute. Like, I just explained it. You're like, oh my God, you made it 10 times worse.
Coming up, Patton explains why he wanted to include a bit about the Me Too movement in his special that is hard not to view as a direct comment on Louis C.K. And later, he looks back at his first ever acting gig as a video store clerk on Seinfeld. Did you know that the Daily Beast recently launched a crossword puzzle? It's made to let news junkies like you flex your mental muscles with clues based on what's happening in politics and pop culture. Head on over to thedailybeast.com/crossword-puzzles to play now. It's a great way to pass the time, and it's free.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why UnitedHealthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
One other piece of your special, to go back to that, that I wanted to touch on is the Me Too bit, which is, I thought, one of the funniest and sort of most interesting takes on the Me Too movement that I've heard in stand-up, which there have been a few, but not, I would say, not too many yet. Mm-hmm. Why was that something that you wanted to tackle in the special?
Because it is something that I think it's very, very much in the atmosphere, and it is something that, as a comedian, it feels a little weird not to address it because it's a huge cultural shift that's going on. Mm-hmm. I think for the better, but I was also trying to bring in the stuff that, like, I was trying to embrace. There's going to be a lot of really dumb, well-meaning male takes on this. Mm-hmm. I'm not as fascinated with the people that are the enemies of progress. I always love the people who think that they're allies, but they fumble it.
Yeah.
Like that was that whole thing I did two specials ago about the people that get all angry about people using the wrong language. Mm-hmm. And I was like pointing out, well, but a lot of times it's the shitty people actually learn the correct language very quickly so they can sneak their evil stuff in. But you're getting so hung up on a guy going, it doesn't matter if a guy's a tranny and wants to, why did you say tranny? No, mm-hmm. He's basically like, so.
Yeah, yeah.
I like the, because there's been a lot of times when I have been who I thought was being an ally and I fumbled it. Mm-hmm. And that to me is, I'm never, what's funny to me is not people being mean to each other. What's funny to me is people trying to be well-meaning and trying to be nice and fumbling it. Mm-hmm. That to me is always so much more fun. So yeah. I kind of wanted to embrace that with the whole Me Too thing.
There's porn for everything. So was there porn for this? And I just missed it? Like, was there porn for jerking off to the unwilling all these years? And it just was off my radar? Like, were there 900 numbers where it's like, our hottest operators are just trying to get to the copier machine? Ooh, but you're blocking the hallway, aren't you, stud? Call 1-900-JUST-FINISH already.
A big part of what you're talking about is, men who masturbate in front of women against their will. And I think that it's easy to view that as a comment on Louis C.K., who that's, what he did and is known for. Was that on your mind when you were doing it? Or
no, because I don't know why this didn't get more attention. I don't know why he became the poster boy for it, because mm-hmm. I was reading a lot of these articles in Me Too, and it was a lot of guys. It wasn't just mm-hmm. like Louis yeah. and Weinstein. It was so many people. It was like, why? I honestly felt like an Amish person coming out at like Rumspringa going, I did not know this was a thing. And I thought I was a pretty deep perv, and I had never heard yeah. that as like a thing that was a turn on. And it was dozens of reports landed on that very specific thing,
yeah.
which really confused me. I just did not know. And also, so I wanted to talk about it in more of a bigger sense, because mm-hmm. that was the thing that I thought that was kind of overlooked in all mm-hmm. the reports about this, is that why is that such a kink among men? Is mm-hmm. that something that needs to be looked at a little more? I don't know.
Yeah.
yeah.
So this is a hard pivot, but I wanted to touch on the HBO documentary series that just got announced mm-hmm. yesterday, I believe, as we're talking. Based on I'll Be Gone in the Dark,
yeah.
Which I guess you are involved in creating that yeah. series. And so how did that kind of come to be, and what can you share about it?
It came about kind of the same way that, finishing the book came about. I, went to people and said, hey, I think this needs to get done. I mean, with the book, I went to Billy Jensen and Paul Haynes and went, please, please, help me finish this book. I don't know what to do. I don't know how to do this. And they really stepped up. And then with the series, Liz Garbus, who's probably one of the best documentarians working today, came to me, and to her credit, I didn't see how it could be a series. And then the way mm-hmm. that she mapped it out and the way that she has structured it. I mean, I've watched the rough cuts of the episodes. It's astounding that it's Michelle's story, but it's also the story of the case, the story of the killer, and then most importantly, the story of the victims, which mm-hmm. really, really kind of, I've met a few of the survivors, at like book readings, and it's just the most humbling experience to meet people and see them, you know, so vital and alive and present and in the world, and going to the trial every day and just looking at Joseph D'Angelo, and mm-hmm. and he won't return their gaze, which they go makes us feel so good to see him reduced to mm-hmm. this hunched over guy that can't look around, you know, just get to see that kind of resilience and endurance kind of really quiets you a little bit.
Mm-hmm. I saw you were interviewed a lot, obviously, right after the arrest of the man who's known as the Golden State Killer. Mm-hmm. And you, at the time, expressed interest in meeting with him. And I was curious if that's something that you still want to do, or have you done, or is that something that you're thinking about?
What I said, though, I didn't express interest in meeting him. What I expressed interest in was getting to ask him the questions that Michelle never got to ask. So it wouldn't be me meeting him going, you're going to talk to me. All I'd be doing is I'd be transmitting the messages from Michelle and the questions from Michelle and to see either what his answers are, or as I've seen from talking to the survivors and the victims' families, watching him just unable to even look at me or answer the questions or want to like leave the room, which I suspect would actually happen.
Yeah.
It will be, so it's not that I want to meet him. That's a very egotistical and wrong thing for me to ever want. It should be the victims that should be allowed to sit down with him. It should be the investigators, you know, or it should be the journalists that worked on the case. But all I'd be doing is transmitting information. It would have nothing to do with me.
Yeah. I know there are issues around the death penalty with his case, that they're kind of appealing for a deal that would give him life as opposed to the death penalty. Do you have thoughts on that, or where do you fall on that?
I've been thinking about this for a while. Obviously, you want, you know, there's a part of you that's like, well, he killed people, he should be killed. Mm-hmm. But if you're looking for closure, and Michelle was very anti-closure, the idea of closure, she thought that was a myth that actually ended up doing people more harm than good, because they would go, oh, he just was put to death but I still feel horrible. Mm-hmm. I think you shouldn't think in terms of death being the ultimate penalty. You should find out for these people, for these killers, for these, you know, criminals, what do they value the most? Figure out what that is, and then take that away from them.
Mm-hmm.
Because what he took from these women was decades of peace of mind, took away a normal life, took away a chance to exist in the world, totally under their own agency and under their own power. He took that away for seconds of pleasure, and took it away because of vengeance. So if he most values being alive, then absolutely he should be put to death. But are there other things he values more, and can those be taken away?
Mm-hmm.
It's why, you know, some people that are like, I remember there was an investigator that talked about, you know, Richard Speck, who died in prison and was never given the death penalty, murdered 8 nurses. It was really horrible. But that footage came out of him, like, doing coke, and he had, like, fake breasts, and it was just... And the investigator was like, well, but look what he had been reduced to. He was a guy who wanted to overpower women. And now he's basically being passed around this prison as like a plaything at other people's commands, like in a weird way, that maybe that was a punishment even more fitting than death for someone like him who wanted to wreak that kind of pain and vengeance in the world. Like maybe find out what these people value the most and take that away.
Yeah, the death penalty is not always the ultimate.
For some of them, I don't think death, they don't care. That wouldn't create the kind of terror that losing, you know, what freedom or whatever. So like that kind of thing.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean that's kind of how yes, part of that is I'm rationalizing stuff, but you know, maybe that gets you closer to closure.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know.
Yeah. So before we kind of start to wrap up here,
sorry, we went to such a dark place.
Yeah, that was
my
dark.
God.
So we're gonna lighten it up if that's okay. So what we do towards the end of the show is kind of go through some of the credits in your career that we didn't get to talk about and see if there's a story or memory that pops to mind. So we'll do that. So I wanted to start with what was really your acting debut as the video clerk on Seinfeld. Quite a long time ago. How did that happen? And what do you remember about shooting that scene?
I remember a couple things. It happened because I went in and I auditioned. And the reason that I got the audition, Larry David told me this years later, was because when they were reading George's lines to me, Jason Alexander's lines, mm-hmm. just being a pest, I did it subconsciously for my years of working retail. Mm-hmm. I started looking around for another employee to pass him to. Like I was subtly, which is what you do in retail, like when someone's being a pro. And Larry really laughed at that. He's like, oh God, that's exactly what you do. You're like, can I pass this guy off? The thing I remember most, because I love Jason Alexander so much, was right before it's my first scene ever, and I'm so nervous. And right before we shot it, Jason's at the counter. He just goes, it's not too late to be fired, Pat. And then which made me so happy, like, because it just killed all the tension, and it was great.
Yeah. I'd like to rent breakfast at Tiffany's.
This is out. Someone has it.
Out? Oh no, I've been to four other places. You're the only ones that have had it.
Well, I can put it on reserve for you if you'd like.
Maybe we could call them and ask them to return it.
Oh, sorry, we can't do that.
Well, maybe they're done with it. I could go pick it up.
I don't think so. It doesn't work that way.
I wanted to ask about your late night stand-up debut, which I believe was on Conan, but you can tell me if I'm wrong.
Yeah, my late night debut was on Conan O'Brien. Yes, that was. On for talk shows, yes. My first ever one was on Conan O'Brien. Yeah, that's right.
And so what do you remember about that
I remember
experience?
That I got it after four auditions. I had to audition for that show four times. The very first audition that I ever did for Conan, they were in L.A. They came to L.A. They were auditioning a bunch of people. They put me up on Latino Comedy Night at the Laugh Factory.
Oh, perfect.
Carlos Mencia brought me up. It was all Latino comics. Amazing crowd. But his intro to me was, all right, this next comedian's a white boy. Now give him a chance. Give him a chance. And I went up and just ate it so hard, rightfully so. Ugh. And then luckily they let me go to New York and do other stuff. But it took a while, you know. Mm-hmm. But then it just really clicked. And Frank Smiley and Paula, and I'm blanking on her last name, but they're the two talent bookers, and they're so good at working with stand-ups. And I'm so glad that, you know, Conan is still a show that likes to showcase young stand-up comedians and young voices. And that, I think, is so crucial.
Yeah. You mentioned King of Queens, which was obviously a big thing for you at the time. And I think the moment, your King of Queens moment that gets the most attention in retrospect is when you stood still for a whole scene.
The writers on that show were such weirdos. They were all stoners, and they would slip. There's all kinds of weird hidden things.
Really?
The name Yuspa keeps getting said a lot. Hey, Eddie. is a weird thing that keeps getting said. And so they would just do, like, let's just do weird stuff. So I think one of them was like, hey, you don't have any lines in the scene. Just stand stock still and let's see if it goes through. We just did it. It was so weird.
And it's kind of, nobody seems to, or people maybe noticed at the time, but it got kind of rediscovered on Reddit years later.
It was really fun. It was just, I mean, they were always doing stuff like that on that show, you know?
So we're talking just a few days after the Parks and Recreation reunion special, which was a lot of fun. And you obviously have a very famous moment on that show as well, the Star Wars filibuster. Mm-hmm. So what do you, when you think back at that experience, what stands out to you?
Terror, because I was so excited to be on the show and I was such a fan of that show, still am. Mm-hmm. That's one of the best sitcoms ever been on TV. That was like a free Tom McCarthy short film every week. That's how good that show was, in my opinion. And so to get asked to be on it, I was so like, I don't want to fuck up. I don't want to be unfunny on this show. So when they had me do that scene, I was just supposed to start, you know, filibustering for like 10 seconds. They were going to cut away. That was going to be the joke. Because, oh God, it's going to filibuster. And then they just didn't yell. They go, just let's not yell cut and see what happens. And I just kept going because I was like, they haven't yelled cut. I don't want to fuck the scene up. And it turned into this trivia dump of everything that was in my head at the time.
Article 7, Section 3 allows for a citizen filibuster. If I stand here and refuse to yield my time, you are prohibited from voting on the bill. Let the filibustering begin. As many of you have noted that use the internet, it has been announced that Disney has required the rights to the Star Wars franchise, and in the summer of 2015, we will see the release of Star Wars Episode 7. Herewith is my proposal for the plot of that movie.
And while we're on Star Wars, we're also talking just after they announced that Taika Waititi is going to be directing a Star Wars movie. I know you're a big fan of his and Jojo Rabbit, and you're pumping your fist right now. People can't see that, but are you excited for that?
I could not be more excited. I just rewatched What We Do in the Shadows because I was going to rewatch the TV series, and he's such an amazing director. He has so much and they're doing the right thing with all these Star Wars films, giving them to really interesting, cool directors. Just like after George did Star Wars, he was like, okay, let's give Empire to Irvin Kershner. Let's give Return to Mark Hahn. Let's give it to these really just solid pros that know how to, and then can bring cool touches to it. And so, yeah, I could not be more excited to see it.
Any predictions or what you would want to see from a Taika Waititi
Star
Wars film?
No, that's what I love. There's nothing to predict. I thought The Last Jedi was fantastic. I don't know. I don't understand all the hate for it. He did everything you don't expect. He went every new weird direction, which is the same thing that made Empire so much fun. Like, oh, whoa. Okay. And everyone's like, no, you're supposed to do this and this and this. Why would you want a movie to meet your expectations? Don't you want it to surprise you and startle you? Why are you paying money to see something that's going to give you what you flatly stated you want? It's just,
exactly.
Parrot back I'm going to say this thing now. Parrot it back to me. Here's $20.
Yeah. That's what people want.
I don't get it.
Well, hopefully there will be movies again, and they can make it. That's
I hope so.
Yeah, I like that they're announcing it, but it's like, well, I don't know. It's going to happen sometime.
And also, I don't know what it's going to be about. I don't know what he's going to do, and I want to keep it that way.
Exactly.
You should not, as a fan, go, oh yeah, make this thing, and please, here's my checklist. I expect these boxes to be checked off. Shut up.
We end every episode by asking comedians, who is another comedian who has made you laugh the hardest in your life? It could be someone you saw on stage or someone who you know, just, you know, hanging out with them. So who's someone who comes to mind that really has made you laugh over the years?
The one who keeps consistently making me laugh is Todd Glass. You know, David Cross once said, he was like, God, Todd Glass makes you laugh so hard, you think you're going to throw up. And I've just seen him do stuff I can't even describe. I mean, his bits are hilarious, but then he'll do these things where he wants every show to be its own event. So he'll just, the way he messes with the audience, with the other comedians, it's just so, just such a piss take on everything. And it makes me laugh. And just in person, he's amazing. I went to dinner with him and my manager, Dave Rath, like, this is a few months after Michelle passed away. So we meet at this restaurant. Todd Glass has this sealed envelope, like a letter. He goes, you don't have to read this now. You can if you want to, but I wrote this to you. I know you're going through a really hard time. Maybe this will help. If you want to, you can open it now. Like, doing this letter. I open it up. It's like a torn off piece of like yellow legal paper, like this big. And it said, I patent. Like, in his mind, that was going to make things much better. It made me laugh. And it just so brought me out of the funk. Like, oh yeah, that's right. Yeah. Just like nothing he could. But it was just also his way of going, well, nothing I can do is going to help.
Yeah.
I'm going to do the dumbest thing possible.
That's so great.
And
I
then,
love that.
Which ended up helping immensely.
Yeah. That's great. That's amazing. He's great. This was so much fun. Thank you so much for talking with me.
Dude, thanks, man.
Yeah. Awesome. All right. Good
well,
luck.
Have a great day. And I will, I have the Dropbox link. I'll send you guys
yeah,
the quick time
perfect.
Audio.
Perfect. Thank you. That's amazing.
Thanks,
and
dude.
And we'll post the podcast when the same day the special goes up. So it'll be
wow
synergy,
you.
You know?
I can't wait. Take it easy.
All right.
Okay.
Talk to you later. Bye. Thank you so much to Patton Oswalt for being my guest on today's show. Starting today, you can stream his brand new stand-up special, I Love Everything, on Netflix. And look out for the new documentary series, I'll Be Gone in the Dark, coming to HBO on June 28th. If you like this show, please tell your friends and rate and review us on Apple Podcasts. You can find me on Twitter at Matt Wilstein and at thedailybeast.com. And if you're not already, please follow at LastLaughPod on Instagram. The Last Laugh is distributed by Acast for The Daily Beast, with audio production by Red Rock Music. Our theme music is by Claude, who you can find on Instagram at claude.mp3. You can find this show every week on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen to podcasts. And as always, you can find show notes and highlights from each episode on thedailybeast.com. See you next week.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.